that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Jericho Brown, author of, most recently, The Tradition, published in 2019, and as editor, The Selected Shepherd, The Poems of Reginald Shepherd, published in 2024. Jericho is the director of the Creative Writing Program and a professor at Emory University. Jericho, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
I love that. I love the title of this, The Right Question. I like that.
Jericho, depending on when this conversation airs, you are either on your way to Montana, in Montana, or you came to Montana as a guest of the University of Montana's President's Lecture Series for an event honoring Martin Luther King Jr. and celebrating Black History Month. So I wanted to start there. Your lecture is called The Art of Dreaming, From Langston Hughes and MLK to 2025. Tell me about what our listeners and attendees to your lecture might expect to walk away from that lecture feeling or desiring.
Oh, wow. That's a really great, so far you're asking the right question. What I want anybody who encounters me in any way to feel when they walk away from me is more inspired, more hopeful, better, changed. And when I say feel better, what I mean is in a position where one can feel her emotions better than she was able to feel them before. I think there's a lot in this world that calls us away from ourselves. And I think we can get in a habit of doing everything possible not to feel our emotions. I believe that if there is any complaint about poetry, if there is any a feeling of animosity toward poetry from people, it really has to do with the fact that people have a hard time dealing with their emotions. People have a hard time dealing with vulnerability and intimacy. And I think poems, when people don't understand a poem, often they don't understand the poem because they don't want to be vulnerable. And they're and they're not interested in intimacy enough to get vulnerable. What I tell my students and what I have told people all over this world now is I find that it seems that everybody wants to fall in love and yet nobody wants to be vulnerable, but you don't get to truly fall in love unless you're vulnerable. And I think the kind of vulnerability necessary for falling in love is the kind of vulnerability you have to really allow a poem to work on your soul and work on your life. And so I think what people will feel is a sense that they can at least sit with their feelings. I hope that's what people will feel, and that no matter what feelings they have while they're sitting through my lecture, that they come away understanding that those feelings were good feelings because they were their real feelings. So, I hope that answers your question.
It does. It sounds like poetry in its basic form, or at its most basic, is the poet giving their readers or their listeners very tacit permission to feel whatever feelings arise in that reading.
Exactly. That's why one of the things that I love about poetry, and one of the ways that I know poetry is a high art, a fine art, is because it asks for our participation, which is why a poem must be clear, and because of its clarity, allow me to see things that you don't see, Lauren, though we're reading the same poem, and allow you to see things that I don't see. That has to do with the fact that every word has a story, and each story, each word in a poem you and I are going to encounter those words differently because we're born in different years, because we're from different places, because we have two different religious backgrounds, or maybe one of us has a religious background and the other one doesn't at all. Or so, do you understand what I mean? Like, and that's what poems are here for. They bring us together in the same text so that we can, as a community, allow for various kinds of feeling to exist around that text, and we can live with that without stressing out. Do you know what I mean? This is literally what Keats is talking about when he talks about negative capability. Negative capability ultimately has to do with the fact of whether or not you can live in ambiguity without stressing out. And can you be aware of that? Can you be aware of the fact that, oh, I live in some ambiguity? I'm reading this text and I feel ambiguity happening in my spirit without having a heart attack. Can you do that? You know what I mean? And that's what poems ask of us. And that is a huge ask. That's a huge ask in a century where everything, every piece of media, everything about our political system, our government, everything about the way we come in contact with each other, everything seems set up against vulnerability. Everything tells us to be firm, to be strong. Do you know what I mean? Everything tells us whatever you do, don't get taken advantage of. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
And much of that is probably necessary, considering, and yet we want to read a poem and we want to fall in love.
You spoke briefly to this sort of difficulty that, or this idea of difficulty that poetry is given, that people maybe aren't coming to poetry because it seems difficult, or there's a reputation of difficulty. And yet you've said before that poems should be and are meant to be difficult. Explain your thinking behind that particular belief. And it kind of sounds like it might be part and parcel of this same conversation about vulnerability, but explain that belief for me.
Well, I'll say a few things about that. One, maybe I'll say two things. One thing is that difficulty is different for different people. And your experience of reading a poem or a poet over a period of time, given your own life experience, your experience of reading a poem might change given what you go through in this very heartbreaking life we live, or very celebratory life we live. My experience, for instance, of reading a poet like Wallace Stevens is that when I first encountered him, I was not interested. And then I kept on living until I got to a point where I needed Stevens as a part of my own personal poetry canon. So that's one thing that I have to say about difficulty, right? That which might seem difficult to you is also might not that which might seem difficult to you might not be difficult. It's just waiting. It's asking for you to live a little more before you can take it in, you know? The other thing that I have to say just about the difficulty of poetry is that another way to think about the word difficult is, and maybe a better word than difficult, is challenge or challenging, right? And there are so many people listening to this radio broadcast right now, and as soon as I stop talking, they're going to start playing their video game. And they're going to play their video game not because it's easy. They're going to play it because it's challenging. Right. And there are a lot of people who later tonight are going to, you know, they're going to meet up for their weekly spades game. This is going to happen with a lot of Black people all over this country. They're going to be playing spades. They're going to have their spades partner, and they're going to be paying against two other people. And they're going to be very serious about that. And they're going to be paying very close attention to those cards. And they're going to be thinking strategically as they play. And there is something that happens. I know because I've played a lot of cards. I've played spades. And there is something that happens when you win books in spades, when you win a spades game, you feel as if you have accomplished something in spite of the challenge of that accomplishment. And I think anything that's really good to us, part of the reason we like it, has challenge involved. Part of the reason we grow from it or learn from it. Part of the reason why we appreciate the challenge of it, Part of the reason why we appreciate its results is because of the challenge of it. Does that make
It
sense?
absolutely does.
And so that's why I say poems must be, I mean, poems should, yeah, they must be. Of course they're difficult. Of course they're difficult. Why wouldn't they be? They're poems. They want all of you. Do you know what I'm saying? They don't want to leave anything behind, you know?
And they ask of you your vulnerability, which you've already said, is really hard to give. It's hard to be vulnerable.
Unless you're in practice. Now, if you're in practice, you know, another thing you can practice is discernment, but that's not what we're here to talk about. That's not what we came to talk about. We came to talk about vulnerability instead, in order to get directly at poetry in this moment. And so, yeah, a difficulty has to do with vulnerability. And I wouldn't want to live in a world where, I mean, I wouldn't be interested in poems if they were easy. They wouldn't be what they are.
You're listening to A Conversation with poet Jericho Brown. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Bookworks of Whitefish, offering new books of all genres, stationery, and puzzles. Open 11 to 6 Monday through Saturday and located in downtown Whitefish, Montana, in the 3rd and Spokane Building. The University of Pittsburgh Press published a book of selected poems by Reginald Shepherd last year. It's this collection that you edited, Jericho. Will you introduce our listeners to this poet? He's someone that I was not super familiar with before I came to this collection. So introduce Reginald Shepherd to everyone. Who was he as a poet, as a member of community?
Reginald Shepherd was a queer Black poet in the late 90s and very early 2000s. I mean, he was writing for a long time before then, but really came to prominence during that period. And I loved his work. I was always excited about his work, partially because he was just so smart about poetry. He also came to prominence during a time where we still did things like read blogs. There wasn't social media as we know it now. And he would write what seemed to me these brilliant essays. And it was clear that he was writing them that morning. You know what I mean? Because the next day there would be another brilliant essay. And I think through reading those essays and through reading his work, I learned a lot about poetry and I learned a lot about the diversity of humankind. And so when Pitt approached me about the opportunity to edit his selected poems, I jumped on that opportunity. Some things you do because you think for a second, some things you don't say no to because you think, well, if I don't do it, I don't like who I imagine they're going to pick. But other things you do just because you really want to do it. And somehow or another, I don't know how, even when I was a very young poet, when Reginald Shepherd first died in 2006, before I even had a book, I imagined that I would be the person asked to edit his selected poems. And so, because I had already imagined that, there's a way that I had been working on the book already in my head. And since I had been working on it already in my head, doing the work of putting the poems together for that book, while it was difficult, it was enjoyable for me because I had a vision and I could put poems together based on that vision. Can I read you a poem by Reginald Shepherd? Because you asked to know
Heck yeah, you can.
more about who he is. And I think I mean, for me anyway, if somebody's asking about who I am, I want people to answer with a poem. So let's see if we can do that for Reginald Shepherd. My mother was no white dove, no dove at all, cooing through the dusk and foraging for small seeds. My mother was the clouded overnight a moon swims through, the dark against which stars switch themselves on. So many already dead by now. Stars switch themselves off and are my mother. She was never so celestial, so clearly seen. My mother was the murderous flight of crows, stilled, black plumage gleaming among black branches, taken for nocturnal leaves, the difference between two darks, A cacophony of needs in the bare tree silhouette, a flight of feathers scattering black. She was the night, streetlights a prose, perch for the crows, their purchase on sight. Obscure bruise across the sky, making up names for rain. My mother always falling was never snow, no kind of bird or pigeon or crow. I like that poem a lot.
Oh, that's a beautiful poem and a really good segue into a question I want to ask you about, well, the relationship between you and Shepherd's work. But you write in the introduction to this selected that his poems reflect a number of things, one of which is the beauty of the natural world through the lens or through an understanding that the world itself is endangered. And moving briefly outside of his work, I was really taken by, and am really taken by, your work, Jericho, your ability to embed and conflate human and natural landscapes in your poetry, especially in the tradition. And I felt that in that book specifically, you too are sort of commenting on endangered bodies. And I'm curious about what your relationship is to the natural world, your experiences within it, and where that impulse is specifically within you to draw human and non-human bodies together within your poetry. And then, yeah, I guess like where you see the intersection of your poetry, and maybe it's subject matter, maybe it's something else, maybe it's poetics, where yours intersects Shepherd's.
I love the natural world because I know it is invaluable, and I know it's invaluable because I understand that if it were not here, we would miss it. I understand that we walk by trees every day and take absolutely no thought of them. But if we walked by those exact same trees tomorrow and found that they were not there, if we were walking in those places and those trees were not there, we would miss them. And I have that feeling about the natural world, not just because it's endangered, although it is, it clearly is. I have that feeling about the natural world because I know that same thing about poems. People don't think they need poems. People don't think poems are a part of their lives. People think they hate poetry. But if poems weren't here, those same people who think they hate poetry would miss them. And I know that because the first thing I ask a person, this happens to me a lot. I'll be on a plane and the person sitting next to me asks this question that I always think is inappropriate. They ask me, what do I do? And I say, I'm a poet. And then I don't have to worry about them talking to me no more the rest of the flight. But the other thing that might happen is, one of the options is I'll say I'm a poet and they say, I hate poetry, which is so fascinating to me that you tell somebody, hey, here's what I'm doing with my life. And then they tell you back, I hate that
yeah,
thing.
That's awful.
But anyway, they say, I hate poetry. And what I have learned to do over the years is to say back to them, you don't have any poem you love? And when I ask that question, everyone who has ever said to me they hate poetry recites back to me a poem by E.E. Cummings or Robert Frost or Sylvia Plath or We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks, which I've heard twice on a plane. Do you know what I mean? I should make an anthology. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you should, by the way.
And so my relationship to the natural world is that I don't want to miss it. And because I don't want to miss it, and because I understand that I might not have it, it might not be here in the same way or as full as it is now in the same way by the time I'm an old man at the rate we're going, right? Because I understand that, I also understand that I must appreciate it, that I gotta love on it while it's here. How do I express love? One way that I do that is through my work, through my writing. And so the natural world appears in my work, number one, because what you really care about is what you write about. And what you really want to show love to or show love through appears in your writing. People often ask if I'm going to write a poem to or for them. And I think, yes, if you stick around long enough, if I get to know you better, if I love you, you will appear in a poem. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And if you do, do something interesting, turn a cartwheel, you'll get an opponent. You know what I mean? And so that's what I think about the natural world. So that's number one. And then number two, I think, I just grew up with a relationship to the land that had deep meaning for my family, for my ancestors, for my extended family. And I understood it as the way by which we lived. I mean, literally, my dad, in order to make a living for himself and his family, cut yards and weeded flower beds. And so that's the kind of work I grew up doing as a kid. And that always felt good. It felt good to look back at something that we had made beautiful. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it makes sense that's showing up in your poetry.
And, on my mother's side of the family, on both sides of my family, my grandparents were sharecroppers. My mother was picking cotton when she was a little girl growing up. As soon as you could, you learned to pick cotton in on my mother's side of the family. And so there is a relationship that I have to the land, and that there's a way that I think of food coming from the land, and even clothing possibly coming from the land. And so that's my relationship to nature, and that's why I'm interested in climate, and that's why I'm interested in what flora and fauna can do when it is made present in poems. You talked about sort of the conflation of the human landscape and the natural landscape, the natural world. Conflate, I think, is the word you used. And what's interesting to me about that is part of the aim, I believe, of my poems, though it's not an aim I set out for, but when I read them, when I'm revising them, when I notice things about them, part of the aim, it seems to me, of my poems is to remind us that the human world, that the human landscape is a part of that natural landscape, that we are, we're here for a reason. And one of those reasons has to do with our interaction with the environment, with the natural world, and whether or not we can take care of it, and whether or not we can allow it to take care of us.
Jericho, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I do want to end on the tradition, your most recently published work, Pulitzer Prize winning work. When you published The Tradition, you also published a brand new poetic form, the duplex form. So for our listeners who perhaps have yet to read The Tradition or have yet to read poems from it, what is a duplex poem? And what was the world or what was poetry lacking that prompted you to create this form, that prompted this invention? What does a duplex allow you or another poet that another form does not?
I think it allows you a feeling. I mean, it allowed me a feeling of synergy with my own poetic mind, with myself. It was a way of when I was making the duplex, I thought that it was a way that I could put together everything I felt and knew about poetry through form. I mean, the duplex is at once a sonnet. It is also a puzzle. It is also a blues poem. And part of the reason why I made the duplex is I wanted to, as I just mentioned, make something new given what already existed, given what I was already, what I knew, fell in love with, and at that point was probably taking for granted as received forms go. And so then it becomes incumbent upon me out of the need I am having as a writer, because I got these lines and I want to use them because I think they're good. How do I put them together? Do you know what I mean? And so that need arises, and invention follows need. And so then I end up inventing a form, which is indeed the duplex. The duplex is, I have to say, also, I think, allow us to know more about juxtaposition and make use of it. If you're writing them or if you're reading them, you sort of understand, I think, better exactly what juxtaposition has to do with poetry, and why juxtaposition, why setting two things next to each other that seem to have nothing to do with each other. And from the fact of setting them next to each other, you end up with something brand new. You end up with new meaning. That juxtaposition in and of itself is what poetry lives off of. I mean, obviously, poetry lives off of metaphor. It lives off of tone. It lives off of voice. It lives off of music made through the language, through the rhythm of words, but also through juxtaposition, which we don't talk as much about. You know, we talk about voice a lot. We talk about people finding their voice a lot.
Yeah.
We talk about point of view a lot. But juxtaposition seems to me something that all writers are making use of as they move from sentence to sentence or line to line. Can I read you a duplex?
Oh my gosh, that was my next question. Yes, absolutely. And I'll just say, just to jump off of what you were saying, Jericho, I call that juxtaposition, and I don't know if it's I call it or someone that I've read previously has called it, and I've just taken it on as my own, but I call that lyric proximity. So you're creating new meaning, right, between one thing and another that seems so disparate, but together they create a new meaning.
And one example of it that many poets know is that poem by Ezra Pound, bless his heart. the fascist Ezra Pound, who had studied Eastern poetry, had studied Chinese poetry enough to write In a Station of the Metro, which goes, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. And when we put those two things, because those two things are together, they make new meaning. It feels, and because of that rhyme, another element that we're always talking about when we talk about poetry, the rhyme of crowd and bough in that couplet, it feels complete. It feels like music. We know we have experienced poetry, and we know that the content of those two lines have made a new understanding for us. So I'll read a duplex, and hopefully you'll hear some of that come through. Duplex. I begin with love, hoping to end there. I don't want to leave a messy corpse. I don't want to leave a messy corpse full of medicines that turn in the sun. Some of my medicines turn in the sun. Some of us don't need hell to be good. Those who need most need hell to be good. What are the symptoms of your sickness? Here is one symptom of my sickness. Men who love me are men who miss me. Men who leave me are men who miss me in the dream where I am an island. In the dream where I am an island, I grow green with hope. I'd like to end there.
That seems like the perfect note to end on. Jericho, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
That was Jericho Brown, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning poetry collection, The Tradition, available now from Copper Canyon Press. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Jericho, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.